Hi, I'm Fola Fagbule.
And I'm Fehi Fawehime.
Welcome to our podcast, where we explore the themes and ideas in our forthcoming book titled Formation, The Making of Nigeria from Jihad to Amalgamation. Formation is being published by Cassava Republic and is now available for pre-order on their website. You can find the link to the pre-order page at www.nigeria-formation.com. Over the next few weeks and months, we look forward to interacting with you online and hopefully in person soon.
Each episode of our podcast will focus on one theme, idea, event, or character that we covered in Formation, The Making of Nigeria from Jihad to Amalgamation. We'll also talk about how we went about doing the research and what we learned while doing so.
We hope that this podcast will serve as a useful accompaniment to Formation itself when the book comes out.
So, let's get started. Welcome to the 8th episode of the podcast for our book, Formation, The Making of Nigeria from Jihad to Amalgamation. Thank you all so much for listening to us and pre-ordering Formation. We're continuing to see several thousand listens to our previous episodes and hundreds of copies of Formation ordered online. If you're in the UK, Formation is now also available for pre-order from the Amazon UK website. We'll put the link in the show notes. We're truly appreciative of your interest and support. So far in our story, we've gone from a revolution in the old Hausa country to the emergence of a large Central African caliphate and to the fallout of blood and war in the old Oyo Empire. We've also followed the adventurers and missionaries that opened the hinterland of present-day Nigeria to European influence. After that, we described the Clapham sect era, which came out of European missionary enterprise and the hard work of local agents. Then we discussed the arrival of the Maxim gun and the exit of the Bible from the formation story of Nigeria.
Now, last week, we discussed the glorious incompetence. We saw how their impatience and lust for imperial glory led to the catastrophic events that we witnessed all over pre-colonial Nigeria, particularly at Benin and in the Igbo country. We also discussed the international political environment that made it possible for their glorious incompetency to thrive on the ground in Nigeria. Now today, we are going to the heart of present-day Nigeria, geographically speaking anyway. In this chapter of Formation, which we titled Game of Thrones in the Niger Heartland, we're going to discuss one of the less well-known but still very important stories in the formational history of Nigeria. We start in the powerful Nupe Kingdom. We make a detour to Akasa at the coast, and then we spend some time in Ilorin before closing this chapter with the spectacular fall of Bida in 1897. This was probably the most revealing chapter for both of us because we knew very little of the fascinating pre-colonial Nupe Kingdom before we started doing the research for Formation. But by the time our story was written, we had both decided that Nupe was worth its own chapter, for various reasons that we will get into in today's podcast.
Indeed. But as usual, before we get into today's podcast, let's take some messages from a few listeners to our previous episodes. We start with a great question from Tomi Oladapo in Germany about diaspora returnees to pre-colonial Nigeria, particularly the Saro and Afro-Brazilian communities.
Hi guys, Tomi Oladapo here. Great job on the podcast and I look forward to reading the book. Now, I have a question on the influx of the Saros and the Afro-Brazilians. I don't know how much you observed or have written about them, but I'm just wondering what attracted them to Nigeria specifically, apart from obviously those who had roots there. And in a way, are there any lessons for today's Nigeria on how to be attractive to its diaspora and to the wider world?
Tomi, thank you so much, man. Thanks for the question, and it's good to hear from you. You ask a very important question, which intrigued us as well when we were writing Formation. We also wanted to understand what the factors were that drove diaspora returnees to come back to pre-colonial Nigeria, and in particular, what drove their decisions around where they returned to. We discovered that this is actually a fascinating subject, certainly from the perspective of understanding economic development and its impact on culture and society. Several books have been written about various aspects of this phenomenon, but perhaps none of them has looked at it from the exact perspective you are interested in. So information, we touched on it briefly. In particular, we touched on why Abeokuta was such a highly desired destination for Saru returnees versus Lagos, for example, which was the other logical place they could have settled in the early 19th century. I won't spoil it for you by spilling the entire answer here, but let's just say it had a lot to do with the social and political environment for doing business. We looked at the Afro-Brazilians as well in formation, not in as much depth as the Saru. In summary, I think the most important thing we found is that trade, commerce, entrepreneurship, and capital inevitably flows to places where there is relative peace, respect for property rights, and the rule of law to some degree. So in short, nothing terribly original and nothing we didn't already know as modern-day Nigerians. To your question, there's definitely a lesson there in that Lagos versus Abeokuta case study of the 19th century. As we now observe the 21st century equivalent of this trend with diaspora returnees to Ghana versus Nigeria. So I think you're onto something there. So we'll leave it there. Thank you so much, Tomi, for the question and for listening. We hope you enjoy Formation when it comes out.
Thanks, Fola. We also got a very interesting question from my good man, who sent it in from Lagos. He asked about the etymology of Pidgin English, a really important question, the answer to which may be a book on its own.
Ogafi, Fola, double F, double F, quad F. This is Oonwoye Adeoluna from Lagos. As I take the yarn for Pidgin, you suppose know the angle I want to take past ask my own question. Pidgin are the lingua franca of the full Niger, spoken northeast, southwest, or the middle belt. Formation, does it cover the etymology of Pidgin English? How it takes spread? How everybody use them? Did it help trade? Did it help anything? We know say that the Portuguese carry Pidgin come through worry. That the only place it take pass, Saba to Sabi to know, they that the full prepositions we will get. So how it take happen? I don't buy my book, buy my own copy, buy my papa. I won't buy my papa own. All the best, and I wait the book coming out. Cheers, mates.
Chief Nwoye, that is a very good question. Thank you. I wish my pidgin was good enough for me to respond in pidgin, but unfortunately it's not, so I won't embarrass myself. In formation, we make a few references to the evolution of language, which is something that also intrigued us when we were writing and researching. We often wondered how all the interaction we were writing about hundreds of years later had been originally captured and committed to writing. In places where we found evidence to answer the question, we described it. For example, we found records which indicated that Portuguese was the lingua franca for the slave trade at Lagos. And King Kosoko in particular left us with a good trove of written correspondence in that language, in Portuguese, which is how we know that he dealt directly with buyers of humans in Brazil. Now, in relation to your question, the interesting thing for me was learning just how old a language Pidgin English is. As you pointed out, and as I just mentioned, Portuguese preceded it as an important language of trade, and hence a lot of the root words in our Pidgin come from that language. But for a country that only officially became a British colony early in the 20th century, we found evidence of local people speaking variations of English much earlier in the 19th century. For example, we described in one of the chapters a well-traveled old Yoruba chief at Ilorin who had been to Mecca, who spoke English very well. We also described in detail one very remarkable and important early 19th century character named Pasco, who had been born near Sokoto, but spoke English very well and had even been to England. Pasco was critical to the formation story of Nigeria because he served as an interpreter to the first British adventurers who ever traveled in the interior of Nigeria. So apart from the educated Saru returnees who would have learnt English at school in Sierra Leone, these were probably some of the earliest local people to speak English fluently in pre-colonial Nigeria. So another more diligent researcher than us may find in these stories the detailed answer to your question about the etymology of Pidgin English as spoken in Nigeria today. And we certainly hope that Formation helps to lead such a researcher in the right direction.
Thanks, Fola. And thank you so much for the question. We also got one more question from Chris Oseji, who sent it in from England. He asked about the glorious incompetence and about alternative paths that could have been followed in relation to British engagement with Nigeria, different from the one that actually transpired.
Hello, Fola and Fei. My name is Chris Oseji from England. Thank you for this incredible work and series of illuminating podcasts. It's a really, really great thing. Looking forward to the book. I was struck by the last episode about the inglorious incompetence, and I did wonder about some of the different paths that we could have taken. Did you find any serious alternative views in England that could have resulted in a different path for the British in West Africa? For example, comparing our situation with what ended up being the Raj in India. And are there any kind of lessons for future foreign policy and use of whatever soft power Nigeria has going forward? Thank you and keep up the good work.
Yes, thanks, Chris. That's a great question. In Formation, we actually reference some of the alternative thinking, such as it was, that existed in Britain about the approach to imperialism in places like Nigeria in the early 19th century. I think one interesting dissenting voice we found was none other than Charles Dickens, the famous, at least now famous, author. We noted some of his quite acerbic views on the African imperial project, which were definitely not in line with the thinking of the men like the glorious incompetent and their bosses who sent them. So to your question, it is in fact possible to imagine a different approach. And yes, there were in fact serious alternative views. But it's just that the voices and the agenda and the political organizing abilities of the hardcore imperialists eventually outweighed those of any other thinkers or doers at the time. In Formation, you will see how we chronicled the ebb and flow of domestic, social, and political thinking in 19th century England about the question of British imperialism generally, but also obviously in Africa. So it was definitely not a one-way street in terms of the foreign policy formulation environment. Could it have been different? My reading of the historical record suggests to me that it would have been possible, but very difficult for any other approach to have played out, just because of the sheer force of personality exerted by the main actors in England at the time. I'm not going to spoil it for you here, but you'll see how we describe the actions, the motivations of these very strong characters when you read Formation. Once again, thank you so much, sir, for the question, and we hope you enjoy reading Formation.
Thanks, Fola, and thank you again, Chris, for the question. I'll also add that for much of the time, there really wasn't even any thinking. I mean, or whatever thinking there was only as good as the person in office as Prime Minister or Colonial Secretary. The reason we cover Joseph Chamberlain in detail is because from the point of view of West African colonies, he was the one who drove a big change in thinking and imposed his ideas, not just on the colonies, but on the British political establishment. I mean, another example outside of Nigeria might be East Africa, Uganda in particular. You know, the person who made it possible for Britain to colonize that place was Lugard. He was the one who made the case and pushed the idea right there. So thanks again for the question. We got one more question from Nana Ojia, but unfortunately, the background noise was so loud, we couldn't really hear what he was saying. So Nana, please send me your question again, and we'll try to answer it in the next episode.
Excellent. So with that, I think this is a good point for us to take a quick break. And when we return, we will now talk about Nupe and the Game of Thrones in the Niger Heartland. Welcome back. We'd like to pause here and talk a bit about why we wrote Formation, the making of Nigeria from jihad to amalgamation, and why we think this story is so important.
Neither of us is trained as a historian. We both work in financial services. but we share a belief that a careful understanding of history is fundamental to navigating the future. One thing I like to say is that the past is an ongoing business. With more information, we can go back in time to edit the past. The history of Nigeria is a great example of this, as it still affects the present. And if we don't understand it, the future is guaranteed to look just like the past.
Exactly. My biggest hope for Formation is that it provides a nuanced and thoughtful starting point for many future journeys into the history of our culture, politics, and economics. We also hope that it begins a conversation that will help navigate a more advantageous future for the humans of Nigeria.
So, let's get back to it.
And we're back. So, Game of Thrones, Faye. If I recall correctly, you weren't a big fan of the TV show at the time we were writing. So I was the one who first said, you know what, this Nupe story sounds exactly like Game of Thrones. So we have to name it after the TV show.
Yeah. You know, the funny thing is, yes, indeed. I quickly came to see what you meant. I previously had one long, convoluted title for this chapter previously. But Game of Thrones was so perfect because I think the reason why I didn't really get into the TV show was because it was so confusing with all the characters. But, you know, when you look at this chapter, it's perfect.
Exactly. Similar. Very similar. So, you know, in a way, the opening scene in this chapter was also the closing scene. Again, kind of interesting things that we saw play out in Game of Thrones. You know, the Battle of Bida, in which the great Nupe Empire, which was formerly independent, was subsequently absorbed into the Sokoto Caliphate, but was now defeated by an external force, mostly African soldiers, but led by the European officers of a stock exchange listed company in London called the Royal Niger Company. You know, it's quite a story, and it made for very spectacular headlines in the British media, which we quoted. But as we pointed out in Formation, those headlines didn't really tell the story. Even worse, we found that there were very few books about pre-colonial Nigeria that bothered to tell the story in detail for any number of reasons. And yet, this was the story of how the most important 19th century empire in central Nigeria was reduced to an appendage of a foreign company, mostly due to internal political wrangling and disorder. So for a start, let me ask, which part of the prequel to the Battle of Bida did you find the most interesting? For me, it was the extent to which domestic political discord played a role, first in dividing the Nupe among themselves, and then making room for Fulani usurpation, and then decades later for their defeat at the hands of local soldiers led by this British company. So what did you find most interesting about the Game of Thrones in the Niger heartland?
I always used to think of Nupe as minorities, you know, in the way we think of minorities in Nigeria today. So, you know, our thinking is always Hausa, Yoruba, Igbo, and everyone else is a minority. But researching this chapter completely changed my mind about that. They were a strong and powerful kingdom that had a lot going for them. They had their high-quality kolanuts to the clothes their skilled craftsmen made, which was popular everywhere within Nigeria and outside. And their extensive agriculture, even though it was powered by slave labor, and the critical roles they played in important trades happening across Nigeria, like ivory, shea butter, and of course, slaves. But beyond that, I think the biggest thing for me was that they were not just sitting there in the middle of Nigeria to be raided and bullied by people from the north and the south around them. They actually went on the offensive many times, and they were no pushovers at all. Nupe culture is deep and strong, and one of the points we make in the book is that even though the Fulani took over the leadership of the kingdom, they themselves were eventually absorbed into Nupe culture. We see an enduring culture going back centuries that could never be conquered by outsiders. The only thing that could conquer Nupe was Nupe itself, and this is what the chapter is about. The seeds for the kingdom's eventual overthrow by the British were laid by internal affairs that went out of control for so long. Whenever the Nupe were distracted with their internal issues, outsiders were able to take advantage. And this distraction went on for a while, for decades, where Itsus were coming and going and the kingdom was splintered before finally being put back together by Masaba, a king who understood the importance of order and how economic growth could come out of that.
Indeed, indeed. We will talk about Masaba and about the story, which is a truly fascinating story, and which I cannot wait for more modern Nigerians to become familiar with. So we found out very quickly that the prequel to the Battle of Bida was never just about the Nupe. It was also about the ruling elite at Ilorin, who had been tied by the umbilical cord to the Nupe elite even since the time of Afonja. In formation, we tell the story of these ties and the politics behind it. As it turns out, even the fall of Nupe would also not be just about the Nupe, but it was also about Ilorin. But perhaps most importantly, the fall of Nupe was also triggered by the now infamous event at that faraway seaport city of Akasa in the Niger Delta, what I call the Akasa disaster. In several ways, the Akasa disaster led directly to the actions of the RNC at Nupe and Ilorin. In formation, we go behind the scenes of the historical record to bring out the details of the economic and political factors across pre-colonial Nigeria that created this link between the events. Sufei, next question. What did you find most important to note about the sequence of events, which is not often described in the pre-colonial historical records of Nigeria? For me, quite apart from the very disturbing Akasa disaster, which is often interpreted as some kind of great victory for local forces in the Niger Delta against the mighty imperialists, which it was, I was very intrigued by the fact that, you know, events had become so intricately linked between various parts of the country later to be known as Nigeria, long before the actual formation of the country. In effect, long before the arrival of Frederick Lugard as an important personality on the scene, the wheels of formation were already in motion, and the events at Akasa and shortly after at Bida proved it. But what was it for you?
Yes, it's easy to read the Nupe story as some kind of self-contained story with all the interesting things that were going on there. But the truth is that a lot was also happening elsewhere. And I think in this chapter, we join them together. And I think this brings us to an important question that comes up now and again in Nigeria today, that, well, if the British hadn't merged Nigeria, what would have happened? I think we can see here that these people were very, very intricately linked together. Maybe they might not have been part of the same country, but they were very intricately linked, and we don't know what would have happened. You mentioned Akasa and the RNC. A quieter but equally consequential development was how economic policies in Nupe around the expansion of plantation agriculture, worked by slaves, caused a lot of discontent in the general central Nigerian neighborhood. As much as this chapter is mostly about Nupe, what we try to show is how the region is home to the most incredible ethnic diversity in Nigeria that confused all the foreigners who tried to study it. But as we show in the book, this ethnic diversity came at a cost to the smaller groups in the Niger heartland, many of whom just wanted to be left alone. But with Nupe being the biggest boys in the area, they treated quite a number of the smaller groups around quite badly. And many of them held bitter grudges against them, such that the moment they spotted an opportunity to be freed from Nupe's meddling over their lives, they grabbed it with both hands, and it was devastating for Nupe.
Indeed, indeed. Such an important story, and also an important switching of perspective and looking at things from the perspective of the minorities in those days, in that time. And in a sense, the struggle for independence by those minorities who were trying to be free from Nupe and Fulani hegemony, ironically, turned out to be the beginning of the formation of an even bigger hegemon called Nigeria.
Yeah.
Called Nigeria. Deep irony. So let's also talk a bit about some of the personalities we encountered in this chapter. And there were quite a few, as it was a Game of Thrones, there were so many people surrounding it. But which ones stood out for you the most? For me, it was Gogo Habiba, the Nupe princess. She was a merchant, she was a slave dealer. She was a really important personality in central pre-colonial Nigeria. We found her to be important in economics and as a military force as well in this Game of Thrones. I think we found her to have been in correspondence with and trading with Efunwe Tinubu, that other important giant at Lagos and Abeokuta. So those two were really central figures in pre-colonial Nigerian trade and politics. And of course, there was also Emir Masaba, who you've already referred to, who was the most important trader on the upper River Niger for much of the 19th century. We also encountered quite a few RNC company men, apart from their boss, George Goldie, the original Golden Boy. people like William Wallace, for example, who plotted and executed the fall of Bida. So which characters did it for you?
Ah, it has to be the great puppet master, Malam Dendo. From arriving in Nupe as a Malam from Kebbi, he gradually worked his way into the confidence of the ruling elite and absolutely wrapped them around his finger. But his most important political skill was patience. Like Dan Fodio, he was not the first Fulani to attempt a jihad in Nupe, but he was the one who timed his move to perfection. He was so good at as a political manipulator that he almost let the warring Nupe party do his work for him. Like a modern-day Nigerian politician, he decamped from one party to the other, depending on his personal interest. and he even made peace with people he had previously betrayed.
Mm.
We have no photos of him, but I imagine him to be a good-looking man with a very sweet mouth that confused his opponents. Slowly but surely, he consolidated his power over Nupe and established a dynasty that remains largely in place till today, even though they have been absorbed into Nupe culture. So for those who think that the modern-day Nigerian politician who changes sides purely out of personal interest is a recent invention, I hope we can give them food for thought with Malam Dendo's story when they read this chapter information.
Indeed. I really like that, Malam Dendo as the original defecting Nigerian politician. That is so good. I found that, we were limited. I think that we did, quite a deep amount of research in formation. But obviously, this is not the only work that has been done. And there was just so much work that's been done about Nupe. And then, I feel that there's such a deeper backstory to his scheming and his various shenanigans that, we're limited in terms of our ability to capture. But I think that, the essence of it is, as you say, of a defecting politician who really played everyone around him. And so before we wrap up today, let's also talk a bit about the present of Nigeria and the future. I may be wrong, but I feel like the Nupe have not been as prominent in the politics and culture of modern Nigeria as they evidently were in the pre-colonial period. What do you think is responsible for this? Apart from that terribly false tripod of Hausa, Igbo, Yoruba that Nigeria is often falsely presented to stand on, and thinking about the future, what lessons do you think we can take from the ancient Nupe Empire about how to navigate a future for the modern country, Nigeria? Clearly, we can take the lesson that too much internal fighting creates an opening for external forces to exploit and defeat us. We know this already. It's an obvious lesson, which the collapse of the Nupe Empire is a dramatic case study of. But what are the less obvious lessons we can take?
Yes, like I mentioned earlier, this was a huge learning for me in terms of thinking about Nupe, not as a minority group in Nigeria, but as a storied political and cultural force. To use a personal anecdote, growing up in Kaduna on an Air Force base was probably one of the most cosmopolitan places I've ever lived in. All the neighbors who lived around us were from different parts of Nigeria. The officer who lived directly to the left of us was a Nupe man, a very proud man who did not take nonsense from anyone. I remember him starting a pig farm right there in his backyard, even though many people tried to warn or discourage him from doing it. He just went ahead and did it. Obviously, that's just the story of one person, but any Nupe person who knows our history in Nigeria is not going to think of themselves as a helpless minority in today's Nigeria. They would definitely have something to say about the country. But back to your main question, I think the not-so-obvious lesson for me is that you can achieve economic growth and development even in a place that is not so obvious, like Nupe. The Nupe maximized their advantages, such as being in a central location, and so they played the role of connector, of connecting the north and the south. Many of the things they traded heavily, like ivory, came from elsewhere. They also used their position near the river quite effectively by monetizing access to it in the way that countries like Denmark did in the very distant past. Most of this development came under Masaba, when he was able to bring the Game of Thrones to an end for a considerable length of time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is the key point about Nigeria's dizzying ethnic diversity. A gift, if managed skillfully, but a curse, when not.
Hmm.
Just because you're the biggest boy in the neighborhood does not mean you should do as you please to the little kids in the playground. If you do that, you will always be vulnerable to outsiders who will take advantage of the discontent you have created. This is a lesson for Nupe and for Nigeria at large, because we are only as strong as how we treat the weakest among us. So we might be a big country, we might have maybe three main ethnic tribes, but we'll always be vulnerable if we mistreat the smaller groups among us, because an outsider will always take advantage of that. In summary, the lesson for us is, how do we manage our ethnic diversity as a country? And the story of Nupe gives us a very, very big insight into how we should do that, or what, at least what not to do.
Absolutely, absolutely. What to do and what not to do to get economic development out of diversity and to avoid discord and discontent, which ultimately only lead to bad places. So, very important. So with that, I think that this is all the time we have for this week. It's been a great conversation as always. Next time on the podcast, we will start getting towards the peak moments of formation. So by way of background for our listeners, the first 8 chapters of the book really serve to set the scene for the last 2 major chapters, which are much longer, much more detailed, because these are like the quote-unquote the last fight scenes in a blockbuster movie. So we are now approaching those more popular modules of Nigeria's official history. In the next episode, we will start discussing one of the most talked about characters in the history of Nigeria, Frederick Lugard, whom, amongst the several names we gave him in formation, we also called the King in the North. Again, continuing with the Game of Thrones references.
Indeed, information we're probably going to be providing readers with a different viewpoint on Lugard than the popular versions most Nigerians are familiar with. It's a very long story, and we trace it from beginning to end, starting from his date of birth, quite literally. So it may take us 2 episodes to talk through it. Anyway, it should be fun.
For sure. I look forward to it. So that's it for today. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the podcast for our book, Formation, The Making of Nigeria from Jihad to Amalgamation, being published by Cassava Republic, and which is now available for pre-order on their website. We would love to hear from you. You can leave us a voice message at anchor.fm/Nigeria Formation/message. The link to this is also in the podcast notes. Please leave your name and where you live in the voice message. We will play it and answer your questions in the next episode. You can also continue the conversation with us on Twitter by tagging our handles at FF, that's at FOULEEPH, and at Folafagbule, that's at FOLAFAGBULE. Please also use hashtag FormationNG on Twitter.
You can also get more information and updates online at www.nigeria-formation.com. The pre-order link is also in the podcast notes. This pre-order is for a limited edition hardback copy. Please tell your friends and family. We look forward to speaking with you again soon about formation.